Hello and welcome to the third in the series of podcasts featuring two university registrars talking about higher education stuff. Dave Hall of the University of Leicester and Paul Greatrix of the University of Nottingham talk through a number of items of registrarial interest, including some of the more unusual aspects of the registrar role. This includes working with partners in challenging environments around the world, from Afghanistan to Ethiopia to Iraq, and then also to Malaysia and China. Some contrasts with Swedish higher education are also noted before things move on to the exceptionally challenging areas of portraits, diversity, and indeed gas pipelines. We do hope you enjoy it. Hello, we are here again with two registrars talking about higher education stuff. My name is Paul Greatrix, I'm registrar at the University of Nottingham, and with me is Dave Hall, who's registrar and chief operating officer at the University of Leicester. And we're covering all things to do with higher education and things that affect the job of the registrar and just strange things that happen in university. So one of the things that I'm occasionally asked is, what are the strange things, the unusual things about your job? So what would you say are the weirdest things about your job, Dave?
I got involved with a project helping staff in universities in Afghanistan. And it entailed a flight out to Afghanistan and spending a short period in Kabul, working with a team of registrars and I think there's a couple of vice chancellors, with another colleague, a coach, and we were talking about issues around leadership and management. What was challenging about it was I couldn't see how they were going to get anything from me, given the scale of their challenges, opposed to what we were, what we enjoy in the UK. It was a number of years ago. The Afghanistan was coming out of a period of conflict. Investment was being put into the universities. They got a strategy to grow the universities in order both to secure economic development, to improve the education of women in particular, which had been devastated under the Taliban. And they were calling on help from the international community, and getting involved with that was both fascinating. It was hairy going out there. Yeah, when we landed, it was a bulletproof vest on, armed guard in a big armed compound, working with the British.
It's an insurance nightmare, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I didn't worry about insurance, I must admit. But it was... we tried doing it, following it up with Skype. But I was talking to one of the VCs over Skype and on his laptop, and it all went all around him went black, and it obviously he'd got a power cut, and it was completely routine. And his son appeared with a candle, and he could carry on. And he said until the battery in his laptop ran out. And I was thinking, what do I have to offer someone who is with those challenges? And another colleague sent me a photograph because he wanted to talk about filing and storage of data, and I thought, well, you'll need an IT colleague, and he said, no, I don't. And he sent me a photograph of a room which was the size of a big garden shed, and it was full from floor to ceiling with bits of paper just stacked up in these teetering towers of paper. He said, I need help. Where do I start?
Oh my goodness.
And he said it was there were those kind of basic challenges. And again, I spent time out in Ethiopia, and we were working with the university there in Gondar, and it was about trying to work with them on management and leadership issues, and the same challenge: how can I offer you something when the problem with your data infrastructure is the hole in the wall in the IT building? Yeah. Which is what they were showing me was one of the challenges. And watching teams of people building their new administration block by piling on wooden scaffolding, and men and women walking up the scaffolding like the way you see them building the pyramids, in order to construct the building. And you think you have nothing to offer. But they were very grateful. It was a fascinating time.
Yeah.
Funny enough, what they struggled with was ending meetings.
Oh, really? Well, because they were too polite?
They were partly polite and no idea of chairing. So there would literally be a group of colleagues sitting around and talking. And it was talking to them about how bring some formality or structure to a meeting in order to.
So you were able to offer something. You could give them a clear agenda, structure, and minuting schedule.
Yeah, it wasn't what I was anticipating in terms of the development of our education system in Ethiopia, but yes, at that level, they did find it fascinating.
I genuinely can't match the challenge of Afghanistan or the development challenge in Ethiopia, but certainly one of the exciting things when I arrived at Nottingham was the engagement with our campuses in China and Malaysia, which the China campus is only 15 years old, Malaysia is only now 20 years old, so at that time 13 years ago they were both still very, very young, and there was a sense of a real kind of pioneering spirit in both institutions, and they were both effectively starting from scratch, albeit with infrastructure and support from, you know, colleagues, partners in Malaysia and China, but also from the UK. But it did feel like genuinely a kind of frontier mentality, and it was very, very exciting. And it still strikes me as absolutely amazing what both campuses have achieved in a very short period of time, despite all the challenges, despite operating in a different context, despite not having nearly as much resource as the UK has. And yet they are, China is now, kind of 8,000 students, in only 15 years and is, really growing its research portfolio. Malaysia's slightly smaller on the slower growth trajectory, but still done extraordinarily well, got an amazing profile in Malaysia. And, it's just remarkable, really. And it goes to show what can be achieved by colleagues, in challenging circumstances with the right support. So you were offering one kind of support. Mm. My colleagues in the UK were offering a different kind of support to Malaysia and China, but they both help and can help people do remarkable things, deliver great education and research, which is ultimately what we're there to do, really. So yeah, nothing quite on your scale though, Dave. And of course, we've both been involved in a long running program with colleagues from Sweden, from Swedish universities. We've had a very different prospect where you're kind of learning about how things operate in Sweden and thinking, well, on the one hand, very envious of the way things are there, and frankly, what just feels a much more sophisticated way of life generally. I don't know what you've got about.
Well, what struck me, and I went back with the Vice Chancellor and the President of the Students' Union to visit colleagues at Lund because of their the way they have students engaged in the governance and management of the institution, and that's tied into the national legislation that students have to be part of it. So I wanted to see, well, what does it look like in practice? Yeah. If we think we've got students sitting on committees and participating in the governance process, is it really any difference? And what I thought was compelling were two things. One is that they were running all the halls of residence, so they were running the company. But also, when it came to staff student liaison committees, they got to a state where the departments and academic staff and departments, head of departments, were annoyed if they didn't have really good and engaging staff student representatives, and we're challenging the students' union to give them better students to challenge them. And that's where we need to get to. The students on the ground who are the group representatives, if you like, who are experienced in the education day to day, have got a forum in which they're listened to and their views are respected, and they can see what response is made to the concerns that they've got.
Oh, that's, the other element of student representation is, of course, this direct engagement with the Vice-Chancellor or equivalent. Yeah. And they are required to meet with them, I think, weekly, isn't it? And formally, decisions have to be aired at that meeting before they can be ratified, don't they? Yeah. So the Vice-Chancellor has to get the agreement of the students on a week-by-week basis to any decisions the university is taking, which just seems, in our context, to be quite extraordinary.
And it obviously hasn't done the Swedish higher education system any problems at all.
No, none whatsoever. And of course, the other distinct difference between, particularly the you know, obviously in the UK we prize our autonomy, etc. And one of the things that universities nowadays prize very highly is their estate and their buildings, and they see that as a major differentiator and a vehicle for attracting potential students. But of course they see things very differently as well in Sweden, in that, you know, the universities on the whole, well, it's not totally true, but on the whole, do not own the buildings that they're in. They're owned by the state, and there is a state company which essentially provides the capital for new buildings. And you basically turn up and give them a spec, and they say, "Oh, all right, then, and we'll build you a, you know, a new biology lab or a new administration block or whatever it might be."
It sounds like the way to go in one respect, providing it's properly resourced.
Yeah. Yeah, because obviously if everyone's arguing over the 2 million quid in order just to get one building and there's not enough space, then you're in trouble. But I think the only limiting factor is the number of project managers they have to manage all their projects. And but the other remarkable thing about the funding situation in Sweden is, as I understand it, again, a lot of it is centrally held, the research funding is, they are overflowing with unspent research funds, which just seems extraordinary to me, that you wouldn't be able to spend your research allocations from government.
Well, it sounds, when we've talked to colleagues, it sounds like a generously funded sector, but you could say it's a sector which is funded in accordance with the Swedish government's commitment to higher education.
Yeah.
And the value that they see that it derives for Swedish society.
Yeah. Yeah, but certainly visiting Swedish universities and meeting with Swedish colleagues, registrars and the like from those institutions is, I have to say, one of the great privileges of the role that I've enjoyed in the past few years.
I look forward to it when we're going to Sweden. It wasn't so exciting when you're visiting
Newcastle. Is lovely though, and we did hold it here in Nottingham as well.
It was thrilling.
No, I agree. Going to Sweden is a bit more exciting than UK destinations beginning with N.
I think they. Hopefully, they feel the same.
I'm sure they do. So what other kind of weird and wonderful stuff do you have to deal with in your role? Because, I mean, one of the things it seems to me is, in general, if someone doesn't know what to do with something, or it's a bit difficult or a bit complicated or a bit strange, it quite often ends up with the registrar, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is the thing we were talking about earlier, the commissioning the portraits for the great and the good who are moving on from the university, having made obviously a significant contribution to the life of the institution as a chancellor or as a vice chancellor or a pro chancellor. And then there's the how much are we going to spend? Do we spend more or less than what we spent before? And will the person know whether we spent too much or too little? And where are we going to hang it? And can we afford to have any more white men hanging on our walls?
Well, that's it, isn't it? Because, I mean, part of the challenge with all the previous ones is that they are, on the whole, you know, ageing white chaps. And actually, if you put them all together, it gives a really quite unfortunate picture of a progressive 21st century university, doesn't it?
We commissioned new portraits, and so we looked back through the history of the institution, and one of our academics did some research into the actually a number of senior female academic colleagues who had genuinely been unrecognised for the transformation that they'd made to the institution, developing new disciplines and what have you. So we commissioned portraits of them, and also we're just working on now on the university's first group of students were all women.
Yeah.
And the first student union president, Nelly Bonzer, we've got a portrait of her going up as well.
So these are people who've right at the very beginning of the university.
Yeah.
So forgive me, are they still alive or are they?
They've passed on.
So I'm slightly hazy as to the dates at the university.
It was founded, we're just coming up to our centenary.
Oh, are we? Right, good, right, okay.
So 1921. So in fact, the first graduate from the university when it got a charter status in 1957 was a woman as well.
Right.
And she only recently passed away.
Right. So you're commissioning portraits of these people essentially to hang with the other ones to give a bit of balance.
And to actually give a better and more accurate representation of the contribution that a wide range of colleagues have made to the institution over its last 100 years.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, one of the things that we've done, and I know other universities have done this as well, is, I mean, we commissioned a series of photo portraits of current female staff who'd, or students or alumni, who'd done significant things for the university recently, in order that we could have a special exhibition of them, which, you know, was... again, it was a way of essentially getting moving all of those portraits of former chancellors and chairs of council, etc., to a different place and having those much more prominent. And then we replaced those with pictures of international staff to recognise the contribution that international staff make across the university to all parts of the institution at a time when, you know, there is, you know, significant pressure on international staff, you know, particularly from government and Brexit.
One of the strong pushbacks we've had, quite rightly, from the student body is the lack of diversity in the visual representation around the campus.
Yeah.
And that has led to some other portraits being commissioned, and there's a photo wall in the Students' Union. But we're a long way behind the curve in terms of having a staff body which is more representative of the student body.
Yeah, I think that is a real challenge for universities generally. But I mean, it is slightly bizarre that we're trying to address these issues through the medium of portraits, which is a pretty old school way of looking at things, isn't it?
I think it's part of a package of stuff. definitely part of a package.
It's not just about the portraits.
The visual representation on the campus. There's a lot of work now starting in terms of decolonialisation of the curriculum and understanding what that means.
Yeah.
And actually, it has been the most, I can say challenging, enlightening, I think, to be fair, personally, over the last 1 or 2 years, working now with a black majority, a BAME majority, a student union executive, working very closely with them, and getting an insight into what their experience really is. And can they... and where they can't relate to the materials and relate to the community. So it's certainly from Leicester's perspective, where we're 52% BAME students, it is a thing, it is a key determinant of the kind of university we are.
Yeah.
And we have got to catch up with that in terms of both the curriculum and, as like I say, the representation of the imagery that we have around the campus. Yeah.
No, I agree. And I think every university, one way or another, is grappling with the similar things. But, I mean, I have to say, I, for one, will be glad when we're able, you know, the photo portrait is you know, much more common than the traditional oil painting, because they're so blooming expensive. And I know, you know, everyone wants to keep the Royal Society of Portrait Artists in business, and it's good that we still have people who have these skills. But I really resent paying the amount of money that we do for these things.
And you do, certainly when I look at some of the ones that hang around our council chamber, two things. Why did they have to be so big? because some of them are massive. And why are they so dull?
Yeah, it's very much a trend, I think. Some of our more recent ones, two most recent vice-chancellors, are a bit more exciting than the norm. But some of our historical portraits are absolutely dreadful.
And there's no other imagery in the portrait to tell you something about the person or the institution.
Oh, well, except there'll be little clues, right? There'll be a little book in the corner, or a little pen.
You're going to have to look very hard in the ones that...
You're going to look, you know, it's like the old Dutch masters, you know, there are clues in all the surrounding things. Or they're just not very good. The other possible thing. So portraits are one thing, and that is a weird thing. You end up in a position where, you know, you are meeting portrait artists, which is something I have to say I never ever thought would happen to me in my lifetime. One of the other weird things I ended up getting involved in is we had a champion balloonist in the university, right, who persuaded the University Alumni Association essentially to buy her a balloon, which was in the university livery and with the logo on it and everything. And she took it all over the world to fly in competitions. It was great publicity. She sadly died a few years ago, but was a really prominent balloonist. And of course, we were then left with the challenge of what to do with it. with the balloon. And of course, I had no ballooning experience whatsoever and no desire to go up in a balloon. I don't know how you feel about this. But there are very few universities that actually have such a balloon. And we couldn't get a balloon club off the ground, pardon the pun. There was a group of staff got very excited about it and kind of took it on, essentially. The challenge we got is the insurance is prohibitive. And storage and transport costs are a nightmare. Chasing a balloon all over the country is a difficult thing to do. And of course, the bloody logo's changed. So you're left in a slightly difficult position. But never, ever in my wildest dreams did I ever think I'd get into the intricacies of balloon insurance, I have to say.
But it is also something about the scope of the role that can leave you in a meeting or find you in a meeting with a colleague where you are being presented with a challenge of which you have no skills or experience to deal with. I remember one particular issue was we'd just finished the new library building and I don't know what kind of pipe it was. I think it was a gas pipe coming out into the road to meet the mains. And the two, one was of different size to the other. So they'd met up and they were, you know, different sizes. And of course, when I don't know why I'd be brought into this discussion about
your expertise on gas coupling,
the problem of the pipes. And I had simply said, well, don't we just get a smaller one and one that tapers or something? And obviously, I was showing extreme ignorance about, I don't know, volumes and pressure and all sorts of stuff it was into it. But I was thinking, well, it's nice to be asked, but I'm not sure I'm going to add much value.
Beyond your level of competence. Are there any other strange and odd things that you experience in your role, Dave?
A fascinating element has been, coming back to the international travel, we're working in Kurdistan, in the northern Iraq region. This is before the rise of ISIS, because we were on the verge of setting up a university. We're looking at opportunities to establish a campus out in the region, and I travelled out there several times. And that was, it was fascinating to see a region, an autonomous region within Iraq, using higher education as a way of developing their civil society.
Yeah.
And in fact, calling on Nottingham academic.
Indeed.
Who was the Minister of Education who initiated a lot of that. And hence, there was also a very pragmatic reason for wanting and encouraging and paying for international involvement. And that was as a shield against further challenges from other parties in the region.
Yeah, undoubtedly.
And that if you got Western interests in Kurdistan, it would strengthen their security.
Yeah.
And that was a fascinating time. And meeting ministers and seeing how the political process worked. We had a very well-connected and networked colleague who you could get a minister on the phone and be discussing issues with him very quickly. Sadly, of course, with the rise of ISIS, the country had to be put on a different footing and coping with whatever it was, 4 million refugees that they...
So is there anything left of what you did? How is higher education in Kurdistan now?
I'd have to check this. I think they are returning to a situation where they can invest again in studentships.
Right.
So what they were doing was they were putting millions into PhD studentships. Students were going into international universities in across the world, and they're not just bringing back a disciplinary expertise into the sector, but they were bringing back a knowledge of how to run a kind of democratically organised institution like a university. How do you? It's not just about the disciplinary knowledge, but it is as a pillar within a democratic society.
And I mean, part of that process was about providing the administrative infrastructure to enable universities to run as well. And I mean, one of the things I remember vaguely from the time was David Willetts getting very excited about sharing statutes with developing countries as a university statutes and ordinances and regulations, whatever, as a vehicle for helping them to, you know, to build the administrative infrastructure they needed to work as a university. And I think you had a kind of connection with that, didn't you?
David Willetts was on a trip to, I think it was Turkey, and he was going to go to Kurdistan as well. And I was on the visit, and he and I went to Erbil, the capital, yeah. And visited the University of Kurdistan, Howler, which was a recently established English language speaking university, whose governance structure, whose legislation had been developed by some British academic and a retired deputy registrar, funnily enough, as we both know, who had done the work for them. And the vice chancellor there, Sirwan Baban, who went on to become a minister, he was tasked with setting up this first English language speaking university in Kurdistan. I think it's not always been a happy story since, but certainly the aspiration was there, and we helped them set up an English language teaching unit.
Fantastic. And, you know, it just goes to show that all that dry work and dull processing of statutes and ordinance changes does actually pay off in the end in a very productive way. Right, we will stop there until the next time, but we've covered a lot of international and other ground there. But thank you very much, Dave, indeed, until the next time. That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until the next time.